But this, the story of Ruth, I don't know how well you know this story or not. I thought I knew this story pretty well, so I kind of got into it during the week, and I discovered that it wasn't a story that I knew nearly as well as I thought I did. It's a story for people who wonder where God is when tragedy strikes their lives, and when one tragedy after another comes, and you end up with that question, where is God in all of this? This story of Ruth is really helpful for people who find themselves in dark places in their lives. It's also a story for people who wonder, could God ever do anything in my ordinary life? You know, my life is so mundane. My life is so ordinary. People don't really recognize who I am. Can God actually do anything in my life of any substance? Well, if you ever think like that, the Book of Ruth is for you. It's a story that contains many of the fundamental issues that we are concerned about today. It concerns issues such as poverty, issues such as bereavement. And we're going to find this morning that there's the loss of a husband and the loss of two sons in this story. It's a story which addresses the pain which some couples discover when they find that they're unable to have children. That's that horrendous discovery. This book deals with that kind of pain. It's a book that deals with racial tensions. It's a book which deals with issues of poverty and human rights. And I hope as we look at this short little book over these four Sunday mornings together that you find this is a book which really encourages you. August is often a time when we kind of settle back a little bit. And there's no harm in settling back, but it's also a kind of time of preparation as we move into a new autumn session together. However, before we launch ourselves into this story, and if you're a note taker, I know some of you are note takers, here are four things that I want you to observe about this story before we get into it, because it helps us to unlock the story. Here they are. Here's the first one. Firstly, this is a story about the character of God. If you want to have your vision of God enlarged this morning, if perhaps your vision of God has got a little small, and you want to see the big picture of God at work, you will discover some great things about God in this story. In a way, God is behind the scenes of this story, but he is the central character. The second thing that we need to note about this is that this shows us, through some of the characters that we'll meet in this book, what it means to live by faith. When you find yourself in really difficult circumstances, how do you live as a Christian? How do you keep following Jesus Christ? This book addresses that issue. Thirdly, it says to us, or rather we need to remember that this is written in a time and a culture very different from ours. This is 3,000 years old, this story. And we've got to work very hard to make sure that the customs of 3,000 years ago, we move them into the 21st century in a way which makes sense so that we draw the right principles and the right teaching out of this story. And finally, although you have chapters and verses in the book that we're about to read in a minute, there were no chapter divisions, there were no verses when this story was originally written down and when it was told. And so it's designed to move from beginning to end. That's why I'm saying to you, read it if you can over these summer weeks. Just sit down and read the story from beginning to end, because the themes which appear in the first chapter of the book are themes which are developed through the rest of the story. Now, having said that, I'm going to break all the rules and we're going to read just chapter one. Because we want to get an introduction to the story this morning. We want to see how this story starts. It's a story which all of us can follow, regardless of how old or how young you may be this morning. Stories are here in the Bible for us to tell to each other, to see what they teach us about God. So let's read Ruth chapter 1. You'll find it on page 267. And if you can share with someone beside you, because it's really helpful to me if you can see this story as we move through it this morning. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Israelites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and they lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. She was left with two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth. And after they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughter-in-laws prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living, and she set out on the road that would take them back into the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home, a rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud, and they said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you want to come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I still had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this, they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women explained, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara," she said, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem just as the barley harvest was beginning. Well, sadly, most of us are used to seeing pictures like this that are on the screen behind me this morning, pictures of famine, pictures of stricken people leaving their homes with what little possessions they have with them, sometimes packed into a few bags and thrown onto their backs, carrying with them what they have left, trying to find a better life for themselves, trying to find somewhere where they can get food. It's an experience that most of us have little or no understanding of in this country at all. Famine to us means nothing. But if you were to go back a couple of hundred years, and perhaps some of you have seen this, these statues in Dublin down by the river, they are to commemorate or to ensure that people do not forget the potato famine that happened about 200 years ago in this country, when millions of people died and thousands of people were forced to emigrate in order to find a better life. Disasters are part and parcel of life. We've been praying this morning, haven't we, for the floods in Pakistan. We've done what we can as a church to try and support people in Haiti. But when you hear these human disasters, often you will hear in the midst of these disasters stories of great hope that shine out of the darkness of these horrendous events. That's the kind of story that Ruth is. It shines out of the darkness of a very horrible place. If you look at verse 1, you'll see that we're introduced to a famine at the very beginning of this story. And what's really ironic about this is that the famine takes place in Bethlehem, and Bethlehem is called the House of Bread. It's very ironic that this is where there should be a famine. And Bethlehem and the surrounding areas are a very rich, luscious area. They were well able to prepare for the food that they needed for the people who were living around them. Most of us have no experience of famine, have we? And yet we sometimes use that phrase, don't we? I know that I'm guilty of using it sometimes, and I know that we use it in our house sometimes, and I'm sure you may use it as well. I'm starving. We use the phrase, don't we? I'm starving. We talked about the cakes in the foyer, didn't we, a little bit earlier on. Some of you dying to get out and get some of those cakes before they go. But I'm starving. It's a horrible thing to say, isn't it, in a world where there are people who have literally nothing to eat. When most of us really just have to go to a cupboard that's nearby and we'll find some food in it. Or we go to a refrigerator, or we go to a fast food outlet, or we say, let's go out for a meal. This famine, at the very beginning of the story of Ruth, comes at a notoriously dark time in Israel's history. If you're following our series in Joshua, you will know that Joshua ended up on a very high point. Joshua brings all of the people together and he says to the people, this is how I want you to go on. I'm about to die. And he says to the people, I want you to finish well. And the people say, we want to finish well too. And we're going to do what you tell us to do, and we're going to keep our faith in our God. And that's the way Joshua finishes. People say, yes. And then you've got the book of Judges, which comes between the book that we're looking at this morning. It's a very dark time in Israel's history. If you look at the end of Judges, if you've got your Bible open at the bottom of page 266, you'll read these words. In those days, Israel had no king, and everybody did as they saw fit. The period of the Judges is a horrible period in the history of Israel. And they ended up in a situation where people just made up the rules themselves. They just did whatever they wanted to do. And a whole generation of people turned their backs on God, with the exception of a few people who remained faithful. And this little family that we're looking at this morning, I believe, are one of those faithful families. Verse 1 introduces us to the life, this life and death situation, this famine situation, which you could miss, couldn't you? If you read into this story too quickly, you'd miss the famine stuff. And you'd miss the desperation of this little family. Elimelech, their two sons, his wife Naomi, they say, well, what can we do? So the only thing that we can do is actually to move out into a new country. We've got to get away from Bethlehem. Elimelech saying, I've got to look after my family. I've got to make sure that my family survives. Let's pack up. Let's go. And they make this journey from Bethlehem across the top of the Dead Sea and into the country of Moab. You can imagine what some of them were thinking as they made that journey. They're part of God's promised land. We're God's chosen people. Bethlehem, the house of bread. Can you imagine the questions and the doubts that were beginning to spring up in their minds? If God loves us so much, then why doesn't he do something about this? But the famine, as we'll see, was just the start of a life that began to fall apart. Just look with me as how these verses begin to unfold. Verse 2 introduces us to this family who become immigrants in a foreign land. I don't know what it feels like to be an immigrant in a foreign land. Or maybe I should say that if I grew up in Dublin and I'm living here in Northern Ireland, but it doesn't really feel like that. But I know from talking to some people who are living in Bangor what it does feel like to be an immigrant in a land that you didn't grow up in. Can you imagine how it was for this little family? There's a bad history between Israel and Moab. These countries didn't get on well together. There's a bad history because they fought each other. This family wouldn't have been particularly welcome. Added to that, there were the different languages. There were the different cultures. A sense that they would never be one of these people. They would always be the outsiders. They would never really fit in. Can you see how Naomi's life is beginning to fall apart? It starts with his famine. They find themselves in the country of Moab. They're immigrants. And perhaps even that should cause us to stop and think how we treat people in this country who've come from other countries. We don't have a great history, do we? Some horrible stories coming out of some of the areas of Belfast where people are actually being evicted from their homes simply because they're different. Thirdly, as this family continues, the suffering gets worse. Naomi's husband dies. And there's some of you here this morning who know what that feels like, to lose the death of a spouse, a husband or a wife. Someone that you've lived with for most of your life and they die. Huge empty gap in your life. Naomi becomes a single parent literally overnight. She has these two boys to care for. Her world literally is just falling apart. It seems that one thing after another just comes into her life and life gets worse. Bit by bit, everything just seems to come apart. And in the culture in which Naomi lives, if you had no husband, you had no one to look after you. But at least she has her two boys at this part of the story. Because also in her culture, her value was measured by the number of sons which she had. Imagine if we did that today. At least these boys would be there to care for her in her old age. As the story develops in chapter 4, her sons are married. They can't have been particularly easy to marry these boys off. There's no father figure. There's no land. And somehow or other, marriage takes place between Orpah and Ruth and Naomi's two sons. And what do they discover as they get married and as they try to have children? The horrible, horrendous discovery for any couple that they are unable to have children. A devastating and painful discovery for any couple to make. And Naomi's future, the whole family line is at stake. That's why we need to make that transition from the story 3,000 years ago and haul it into the 21st century. It's as if her family line is going to be blotted out. And as if things could not get worse. What happens next in verse 5? Naomi's two sons die. I mean, could life get much worse than this? It's interesting that the two sons' names suggest that perhaps these guys were pretty sick throughout most of their lives. Mahlon actually means to be sick. And Kilian actually means somebody who's failing, probably in health. And so look at Naomi. Overnight, almost, her social status hits rock bottom. Her life is at stake. It's hard for us to understand that today. We have a National Health Service. We have income support, we've got tax credits, we've got free travel. There's so much support around today for people who find themselves, who have been widowed. But Naomi has nothing left. She's at the mercy of a society. Her sons are gone. She has no source of income. She has no way of looking after herself. Her life has literally fallen apart. Now, do you see how easy it is if you move into this story so quickly, you miss these circumstances? This is a great love story that develops, as we'll see in these coming weeks, between Ruth and Boaz. It's a wonderful story to look at on these August Sunday mornings. But the story starts in a very dark place. That commentary that I referred to a minute ago from Carolyn makes a very interesting suggestion. She suggests that Naomi is the female counterpart to Job in the Old Testament. I've never seen it that way before. And as I sort of look at what happened in her life, I think, well, that's right. There is a similarity. And she, like Job, is not afraid to voice her doubts. Verse 21, she's going to make it very clear what she actually thinks and who is the cause of these things in her life. But even Job had a wife and he had a community such as they were around him. They weren't very helpful friends that he had. But this woman has nobody. This is a story that encourages us not to pretend when all is well as Christians. Sometimes we can be great pretenders as Christians. And when the tough times come, do you ever think that sometimes we feel like we've got to give God a hand? We've got to kind of gloss it over a little bit so that the Christian faith doesn't seem maybe quite so bad? And that as Christians we can actually cope better than we actually really can. But you know, when we gloss it over and when we make our troubles and our sufferings not to be as bad as they really are because we don't want people perhaps to think that God has somehow or other done something in our lives, we just want to make things look better. You know, we airbrush a version of the Christian faith. We present a version of the Christian faith which is not real. Eugene Peterson is honest enough to tell us the truth about what's in our Bible. Everybody writes. He says, look, no literature is more realistic and honest in facing up to the harsh realities of life than the Bible. It's true, isn't it? It's all in there. At no time is there the faintest suggestion that the life of faith exempts us from difficulties. On every page of the Bible, there is a recognition that faith encounters troubles. It's true, isn't it? And I look around this morning, I just know in many of your lives, because I've been involved in many of your lives, you've had tough times. Tough times come because we live in a broken world and we can't escape the brokenness of that world. So the question comes in this story, how is Naomi going to respond? She's a widow and she's got two widows which she's now responsible for. What kind of choices are they going to make? Where is God in the darkness of this story? Well, let's just pick it up in verses 6 and 7. Look at it with me. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughter-in-laws prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living. She set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. And the next passage, the next portion of this story, introduces us to the significant choices that these three women faced. Now, lots of us have made choices this morning already, haven't we? You know, what time should you get up at? What will I wear today? What should I have for my breakfast? All sorts of incidental, small choices that are not particularly important in the bigger scheme of things. But there are times when we have to make choices that will have life-changing consequences for us. I want to show you how these three women work through these choices. Their life is falling apart. Their life is hanging by a thread. They have no means of income. Firstly, look with me at Naomi's decision in verses 7 to 13. I want you to notice in verse 8 in particular that her decision goes right against the cultural expectation of her day. Now, this is where you have to work hard to bring this story, which is 3,000 years old, into the 21st century. You see, in Naomi's day, if you had a son who died, then it was your responsibility to make sure that the wife was married again into part of your extended family. That's how things worked. That's how women were looked after. But what does Naomi do? She says in verse 8, actually she says, you need to go back to your own people. She goes against her own culture. She goes against everything that she has been brought up with. Because as far as Naomi knows, at this point in the story, there are no relatives back in Bethlehem. She's a realist. She knows the only sensible thing to do is to release these two women, which she does in verse 8. Naomi says to her daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. Why is she saying that to them? She says, so that you will find, in verse 9, rest in the home of another husband. She wants them to be looked after. And look at the prayer that she utters for these women in verse 9. It's very moving, isn't it? May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead. and to me. But her words in verse 10 are met with an astonishing resistance. She kissed them. They wept. Can you imagine the scene, can't you? These three women bound together by the experience of losing their husbands. And you know, don't you, when hard times come and you experience hard times with another person, they bind you together in a way that other things often do not do. Here's these three women, closer than sisters. Her words in verse 10 are just astounding. They kissed each other. They wept together. And then they said to her, "No, we're going to go back with you to your people." Undeterred, Naomi tries again, but this time, as we get to the end of verse 13, her wave of anger against God comes flooding out. Let me just read verse 11 through for you. Naomi says, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have more sons? Who would become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, and I haven't had a husband tonight, how could I provide husbands for you? And even if I did, how could you remain around long enough?" with what she's saying. And then she says at the end of verse 13, "It's more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." A bit Job-like here. You know, Job says in the middle of some of his difficulties, he says, "You know, I want you to know God has made me his target." He says, "That's how I feel." He says, "Archers surround me. It feels like God's shooting arrows at me. That's why my circumstances are so bad. The Almighty who has made me taste bitterness of soul." That's what Job says. I think this woman is right to say, look, Job and Naomi are very similar in their circumstances. But what about Orpah? Well, she is quite practical in the decision. She's listening to what her mother-in-law is saying in verse 14. She sees the logic of the situation. They weep again. You can imagine the emotion of this story, can't you? These women just bound together, arms perhaps thrown around each other, weeping and crying because they know that somehow or other they're going to be separated from each other. Orpah makes the choice in verse 14 to stay with her own people. She heads home. The parting is very painful. Verse 14, they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. So what about Ruth's choice in this story? Well, I find Ruth's choice in this story startling. Ruth is not a woman who's come from Israel. Ruth is a Moabite woman. Let's just look together in verses 15 to 18. Naomi once more tries to change Ruth's mind, verse 15. She says, "Look, there's Orpah. She's going down the road. Now's your chance to change your mind. Go and join her. Go back to your own people." Verse 15. But Ruth replies, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn my back from you." Ruth's decision to return with Naomi to Bethlehem is not about the future. It's not even about family loyalty. It's about God. Read with me Ruth's response. I find it very challenging. Ruth replies in verse 16, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people." And look at this next phrase. "Your God will be my God." Here's this Moabite woman from a pagan country. This, I think, is the point of Ruth's conversion, if you want to put it like that. She's seen God in action somehow or other in Ruth's life. Somehow in Naomi's life, in Elimelech's life possibly, and she's heard the stories of what God has done for his people, and she says, "That's the God I want to have." And she says, "Even death will not separate us." It's an incredible promise that she makes to Naomi. And the impact of this decision is hard to imagine, isn't it? Because, you see, just a few verses earlier, at the end of verse 13, here is Naomi saying, "You know, this is a really bitter situation that I'm in. God has caused this to happen in my life, and I really resent what has happened." And then contrasted against this is Ruth's devotion to saying, "I want your God. I want your God to be my God. I'm going to go wherever you go, and only death will separate us." It's little wonder at the end of this passage here, when Ruth realizes in verse 18 that Ruth is determined to go on with Naomi, she stopped urging her. The literal translation of that is quite funny, actually. She says she literally said nothing more to her. I don't know whether they fell out with each other, or was a very quiet journey back to Bethlehem, or whether Naomi realized somehow that Ruth's devotion to this God, which was her God, was actually somehow shining a light into the darkness of her life. But the journey went quite quiet. So they return to Bethlehem in verse 19, and the whole town is stirred, which suggests to me that Naomi must have been a woman of some standing in this town. It's hard to underestimate the impact of these events on her life. The events where she says in verse 21, she says, I left this town full, and I've come back empty. Imagine this little family heading out, can't you? Elimelech taking his sons, taking his wife, protecting them, bringing them to a place where they think they'll get food, where they'll be looked after, where they'll have a new life. And she comes back empty. She's lost everything. Perhaps it's little wonder that they had difficulty recognizing Naomi when she came back into the town at the end of verse 19. Can this be Naomi? And here's a story which prompts us this morning to ask the question, what does faith in God look like when our world falls apart? What does faith in God look like in the dark times? Where is God in this story? I want to suggest to you that there are three things going on behind the scenes here that we need to hold on to, so that when the bottom falls out of our world, we know the kind of God that we have. I want to suggest to you, first of all, that this story speaks to us about the sovereignty of God. We've been picking this up in our songs this morning and in our praying already, that God is sovereign. That's one of the things that Naomi got right in this story. She couldn't explain the circumstances of her life, but somehow she knew that God was ultimately in control of what is going on. He is the creator of the world. He gives us life. He sustains us. Our times are in His hands. Naomi knew that, and she trusted God for that, even when she couldn't work out the circumstances. And the New Testament says to us that nothing happens that's outside of the control of God and His will. Naomi was right. And in the good times and the hard times, we need to believe that God is sovereign, that He will work His purposes out. Sometimes we lose sight of the sovereignty of God. This story restores that characteristic of God and says to us this morning, you need to trust in the sovereignty of God. Even if you do not know how a story will work out, God is ultimately in control of our world and of our lives. Second thing in this story, which I see at work, is God's purposes being worked out. God's good purposes being worked out. There's a verse in Romans 8, isn't there, that sometimes as Christians we quite glibly quote. We say, you know, all things work together for good for the love of those, for those who love God. Those are called according to His purpose. Somehow it'll all work out in the end, so be encouraged. Do you know what? Sometimes we don't see how it works out. Sometimes we never see the end of the story. And this is the story which encourages us to trust that God's good purposes will be worked out, whether you see the end of that story or not. And it challenges us to put our trust in that kind of God. See, there's an amazing part of this story which we won't be covering this morning. I don't want to spoil too much of the story for you. But you know what? Ruth goes on to become the great-grandmother of King David. King David is an ancestor of Jesus who will be born in Bethlehem. And through part of this story, Ruth is being brought from a strange land into the land of Israel, and she will become the great-grandmother of King David. Ruth goes on to marry a man called Boaz. Boaz, it turns out, is a descendant of the prostitute who was rescued when Jericho was invaded by Joshua, and she was the woman who was saved. And you see, as you begin to understand something of the bigger picture, you begin to see that God's good purposes are being worked out, that even through people who are not part of the Israelite family, God brings them in and ensures that they are part of the future, because God's good purposes will be worked out. And thirdly, I want to suggest to you this morning that God walks with us in the darkest of times. I know some of you this morning are in dark places. Life has struck you a cruel blow. And I put in brackets this morning, even though we may not recognize it, because you know what, often we don't recognize it, because we're in the dark places, God seems silent. I say, where is God? I can't see Him, I can't experience Him, I can't seem to speak to Him. But we need to trust through a story like this that God walks with us. That even when we're standing in the darkest of places and the future seems bleak, that even when we're hurting and even when God seems silent, as he seems to be in this opening chapter, even when our suffering makes no sense, even when we have no sense of maybe what comes next, Ruth has no idea how this story is going to unfold. Her life is hanging by a thread. And she says to Naomi, she says, "My God will be your God." I don't know how this will work out. I don't even know if we'll make it back to Bethlehem at this part in the story. And for Naomi, there's little hope in this story in chapter 1. As I was trying to illustrate this opening chapter this week, I was looking at some images on the computer last night. I just put in Ruth and Naomi, and this kind of came up, and it sort of struck a chord with me, because perhaps it contrasts the ages between the two women in the story. I have no idea what they look like. None of us have any idea what these two women look like. But as I look at this opening chapter, I find myself looking at Ruth in this story. I'm challenged by what she says to Naomi. "My God will be your God." That's a huge statement of faith, isn't it? No matter how things will work out, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Because I know, I have heard the stories about what your God can do, and I know that ultimately he's in control. I know that ultimately he's working his good purposes out. I know that your God can bring good out of difficult circumstances, even if I cannot see how it's going to work out in the end. Ruth is a real challenge to me in this story. You don't find yourself saying this story, "That's the kind of person I want to be like." But we also need to take a long, hard look at Naomi as we conclude this morning. She is here to remind us that when the tough times come and when our struggles are real, it's all right to be honest with God about how you feel. It's all right to tell him. You don't have to gloss over the story. You don't have to put a better spin on it so that people around you who are not Christians think you're coping better than you are. The story of Naomi in this opening chapter is a sobering reminder to us that there will be times when our suffering will seem to get the better of us and our faith in God is shaken to its very core. What does Naomi say at the end of this story? She says, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara," she says, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full," verse 21, "but the Lord has brought me back empty." Why call me Naomi? Pretty honest stuff, isn't it? But thankfully, this opening chapter ends on a note of hope. Aren't you glad about that? Because I am. Because when we pick up the story next Sunday morning, you'll see that in verse 22, and with this we conclude this morning, Naomi returns to Moab accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law. They arrive in Bethlehem just as the barley harvest is beginning. That little note of hope, just as the barley harvest is starting. Springtime. Two harvests in the country of Israel. Springtime, the first harvest, food is to be found. There's a ray of hope shining into the darkness of this story. And that's where we'll pick up the story next Sunday morning.